Our next speaker is going to be a very different aspect of engineering instead of the mind in terms of aerospace. So we're going to have Ryan Osterbruce from the United States Air Force Academy. He's going to talk about a summary of U.S. Air Force Academy unmanned aviation research.
I'll wait till everybody shuffles in because I know it's kind of a mad dash back and forth.
Yeah.
To get your spot.
I used to fly F-11s, by the way.
Oh, did you?
Nice.
Yeah. I'm
truly
looking forward to
it. Sounds a striking move.
Most of us now are in the boatyard alone.
All right, well, I think we got everybody, then I'll get started. Ken had asked me that he thought perhaps it'd be an interesting opportunity to discuss some technology that we have going on down at the Air Force Academy right now. My name is Mr. Ryan Osterbruce. I'm an assistant professor down at the Air Force Academy. I'm a retired test pilot per trade, and then per education, controls engineer, so astro for an undergrad and then aero for those that are controls folks out there, right? We live in the world, we live on the root locus, right? That's plain, Anyway, so I'm going to go through some of the UAS research and what's happening down there. Obviously, first disclaimer is that these are not the official views of the U.S. government, so please don't. These are actually my opinions on some things, so I have to give that disclaimer. And then the second thing is everything I'm presenting is publicly releasable, so don't think this is anything that, you know, is whatever, sellable. It's all publicly releasable. Okay, so without any further delay, just real quick to talk about our mission down at the Academy. Unlike maybe a lot of other universities, we have a challenge. In that we don't have our students for very long, I drool at the professor that has that student that was an undergrad of theirs and decides to do a master's degree and then goes on and does a PhD and then does a postdoc. What a joy! But we don't have that luxury because all of our students go off and do their job in the Air Force. And so our overall mission is to develop officer character. So I'll talk about the research efforts we've got going on, but keep in mind that we have to cram a lot into a little short area. Everything we do is cadet-based learning, and then we can have some continuous research efforts. They don't have to be class-dependent, but they do have to support cadet growth, so we'll talk about that. On the right-hand side there, we've got one of the cadets that's launching one of our UAVs from this semester. It's called the Flicker aircraft. It's a flight control research aircraft that we developed, and we do a lot of research stuff on it. On the left side here, some folks are from the physics, cadets from the physics department are doing some zero-G kind of tests and those vomit comets, if you've heard of those before. So without further ado, obviously our focus overall is to get our cadets here so that they graduate as officers of character, and it can be challenging, but they're all pretty excited. Okay, so on to the actual research then. I want to take a little bit of time and talk about kind of one of the departments. There are 11 centers down at the Air Force Academy that do various types of research, physics to you name it, the biological, the art sciences, all the engineering divisions, the mechanical engineering, everyone, comp sci, DFDC. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the aeronautics department real quick. Just as to give you some concept of the kind of things that we would do. So obviously we fabricate and build full or subscale vehicles. We have a lot of projects that are funded by the Air Force, either from AFRL or perhaps ACC or Air Force Mobility Command, those types. So a lot of our research is there. Primarily, we integrate a lot of different platforms, either do some flight test validation or flight control development. The nice thing about the Air Force Academy is we own our own airspace. And we have 5 different UAV sites at which we fly from. So in terms of the ability to go out and do research, we've got quite a bit. Those of you that are in the aviation world and in universities where you're trying to get a COA from the FAA and you're having a hard time to find, we don't have that problem, so that is a joy. And we do enjoy working with outside universities. So if you are a university and you'd like some place to come fly, we could probably host you at the Air Force Academy. We have a lot of stuff. A lot of flight areas. Here's the kind of data that we'll try to gather on UAV standard aircraft performance type stuff, drag, polar, pedostatics, climb performance, glide performance, max endurance, and max range. Just quickly, the type of data we're trying to gather, and there's a kind of a power chart and a drag or a thrust required chart, depending on how you look at it. Okay, other things, maybe flying quality, static stability, dynamic stability, and then, you know, flight control research. Which is becoming more and more of our focus nowadays is on the autopilots that are on board the aircraft. I don't know if any of you have been looking, but the kind of the revolution in autopilots is kind of concerning the government and industry, concerning the government, because I can pretty much go and buy a small airplane The autopilots that we use are about this big, and they weigh a few ounces, and they have the capability to essentially fly that plane anywhere I want to. So if you live within 15 miles of here, I could put a plane together that would probably fly to your front door, and with a little extra electronics, I can actually make it fly through the window of your house. So there is a certain degree of, danger or concern going on right now with the proliferation of small UAVs and the autopilots that control them. So that is kind of a large focus. I'm going to move on to some of the projects that we're flying, and then in the end I'll talk about that last challenge that we've got, which is the counter UAS problem that's kind of growing. So some of the capabilities that we're developing right now, everything's going mobile. I don't know if you've seen that, but a lot of the both Army projects and things out there are trying to have UAVs that can defend a mobile convoy, that kind of thing. So we have a truck launch system. This is our airfield out here. It's about 1,800 feet on the right. It's called Aardvark. It's dedicated to UAV research. You can see right here, they have two different launches going on. There's a gentleman there holding a UAV in his hand. He's going to be launching by hand. And then we've got a system that actually deploys the UAVs from the top of the truck. Again, I think you may see Army projects in the future here where they're taking UAVs with them, not just something that's sent from a location to protect a convoy, but actually they may be taking these along with them, kind of thing. So we're getting more and more requests for that type of launch and recovery system, mobile type systems. We discovered that while we're doing that little launch device that's sitting on the top of the truck right there actually makes a pretty good place to mount a wind tunnel, if you will, on the top of our truck. So this here has some load cells in it that gives us the forces in both vertically and then drag and then in yaw. And we can use those actually to get a pseudo wind tunnel solution of aircraft mount on top of a truck. So if you guys haven't tried that, for those of you who have aeronautics projects, programs, we're actually getting some really good data from that because we have a hard time. Down at the Air Force Academy, we have six different wind tunnels. They go all the way from our subsonic, which is, very slow speed, all the way. We have a low speed, we have a subsonic wind tunnel, and a transonic wind tunnel, which takes us up to about 3.5, and we most recently have a hypersonic wind tunnel that will take us up to Mach 6 or so. So if you're working in those kind of speeds, come talk to us. Not many of us are in the hypersonic region, but we've got the ability to do some testing there. But we found that this is a real nice way to get good, clean data, especially if you've got a wingspan that's like this, something that's 8 or 9 feet in the wingspan, and so you can't really put it in any of the wind tunnels that we have. So putting on top of the truck is a good way to go. So now I'm going to move into some of the current projects, which is where I think you'll find most of the interest. So done with kind of the background on what we've got. So this is one of our projects that we're working on. It's tactical off-board sensing aircraft. Essentially, the concept here is this has two wings on either side. The wings actually deploy outward. They're originally folded and bent back against the body, and then these tail wings here are actually folded forward, and the whole thing fits in a tube. Right, so it's a common launch tube. If you have a larger aircraft, C-130, something like that, they'll have these tubes mounted to the side of the aircraft and then boom, pop them out. And then this can go off and do things like gather data for you, potentially gather weather for you, those kinds of things. Our specific purpose is to just validate and test that the whole concept works. And so we're launching it off of that truck that I showed you. With the wings fully deployed, the thing weighs about 15 pounds, and you can see it's a combination of carbon fiber and then SLA printed, which is the plastic nose there. Here's an example of it coming off the truck. Launch speed was 31 knots. I would show you the video, but I wasn't sure it was going to go good. But so there we are passing by at about 31 knots. You can see as it starts to take off, it's got a little bit of a nose up, probably a little more than I would like, but then it tends to settle itself out, and there you have it flying away to go do the mission. So. At any rate. Okay, on to our next project. This next project we're going to present is called 5GAT, and it's essentially a fifth generation airborne target. So the Air Force has a problem right now that we've developed a bunch of fifth generation aircraft, F-22, F-35, those types of aircraft, but we don't have any way to test them against a fifth generation threat. Because currently what we'll do is we'll take an F-16, which is a fourth generation aircraft, not as stealthy, no Super Cruise, that kind of thing, and we'll fly it as a drone and then shoot down that fourth generation threat. But we really don't have a fifth generation to represent, you know, stealthy and super cruise. And so that's what this is. This is actually what we're testing at the Air Force Academy. This is in our research lab there. We're testing a subscale of it. And the primary thing we're trying to gather is the pedostatics on it. So seeing that big nose out there, for those of you who know, that big old nose causes a whole lot of disturbance in the airflow. We don't want to put a tube right out the nose because that's not good for stealth. So we're essentially flying to gather the pedostatics for risk reduction. And there it is, flying at the Air Force Academy. Okay, good. Next project I want to talk about, check my time. Next project I want to talk about is ICE. So it's Innovative Control Effector. And what this is, it's actually a project about the time the F-117 first came out, and they were trying to develop stealth. They decided, how do we make our aircraft as stealthy as possible? One of the suggestions that Lockheed Martin engineers had was, well, if we had an aircraft that had no flight controls, that would be great, because then you wouldn't have the deflection causing reflections from radar returns. So they came up with this Innovative Control Effector. And so really what this is an aircraft that has no flight controls. Now, I know what you guys are thinking. My dad flew 747s for years, right? Who wants to get in an airplane that has no flight controls? It sounds like a very safe thing to do, right? Well, so this is a very interesting kind of design. You can see I chose to put this photo of it in the right over here. It's a delta wing shape because the primary purpose of that type of shape is to generate vortices over the top of the aircraft. So much like an F-18 from years ago would have strakes that let out forward on the forebody of an F-18, that generates vortices that keeps the airflow attached because it's a very low pressure area, and that attached airflow allows the plane to operate at very high angles of attack. And so similarly, we decided we wanted an air shape, and this is about, I think we've done 4 wind tunnel tests now, so this was on our first iteration of wind tunnel tests down here. And you can see the vortices that have been built over the top of the wing here that's in this iridescent and the black light paint. And so what you do is we're going to take the aircraft, and the aircraft design has 3 different, I guess I did need that laser pointer. Does this thing work here? So, no, that's not it. All right, well, I'll just use my mouse. How about this? So the design actually has 3. You can kind of see them right here. And the nose, there is an ejector on either side, little slots right here, one in the midspan of the wing, and then one on the trailing edge of the wing right back here, that eject out high-pressure air. And you think, oh, well, high-pressure air, that's just going to cause the plane to force. Well, actually, you need a whole lot of air to make that happen. I mean, think how much air you need when you put a control surface into the air, into the flow. There's a whole lot of momentum change that's causing that plane to react to it, right? So what this does, it's actually much more subtle and a little more elegant. We're trying to take those vortices and we're actually moving their position left or right on the top of the aircraft. The vortice is a very tight tunnel, if you will, a wind tunnel of low pressure air. So if I were to take that vortice and gently move it to the right wing, that would cause a low pressure area there, which would cause the plane to roll to the left, right? So we're not really using the eject, it's not the mass flow rate that's causing it, it's the movement of the vortices on top of the surface. Now, I'm a controls engineer, so my job on this specific task, although we've been doing some flight tests and stuff, my job is to design the control system to make that happen. So it's going to be a little bit challenging, because unlike a wing, where if I put the control surface up and cause it to go up and I want the nose to come back down, I put the control surface down, this is actually just the aircraft dynamics will want the aircraft to pitch down. And so really what I'm doing is I'm putting in an input, a thruster, that keeps it where I want it, but when I don't want it, I remove the thruster so that the normal pitch. So it's going to be a little bit backwards. For those of you that do control work, I've got a one-sided problem, if that makes sense. So it should be interesting. We're on to the third assessment of it. Here's the carbon fiber version of it that we've got. Hopefully we'll be flying that later this semester. What we decided, we're flying subscales of it right here, you can see. And we've decided, well, we better put some control surfaces on it to start with. So you can see their control surfaces cut in here and here, and then on the trailing edge. And our intent is to fly it with the control surfaces up on condition, and then get everything level, let the thing kind of be gliding, and then actuate it and see what kind of actuations we get. So that's where we're at with this project. And so far, that little subscale has been flying pretty good. Okay, next plane that we'll talk about our current project. So this is the flight control research aircraft. Essentially, it's just a platform that allows us to go out and do a bunch of different flight control tasks. It's inexpensive to produce and fly. Optionally, the Canard is active. See what some of the projects that we're intending to fly with it. So formation flight, very tight flight path tracking, and then precision landing are the types of topics we're looking at. If you've got a moving vehicle, back to this whole moving truck and trying to bring it, our intent is to try to bring and land the vehicle on the moving truck. So we'll see how that goes. But it should be fun. It's inexpensive, right? So if we have any issues, we're not going to worry about it. The next project then is LCAT, low-cost attritable aircraft technology. When the Air Force goes to war, in some cases they'll use cruise missiles or things like that are dropped off of aircraft to do either communications or potentially drop out leaflets, those kinds of things, all those services. But when we employ something like that, normally we don't get it back. It just crashes and we lose it, and that's a lot of money. So the Air Force and their desire to try to save some of those costs are essentially building UAVs that are recoverable. We'll do that same task, but then we'll fly home when they're all done. So this is the first version of it, low-cost attritable. This one had a payload that was in the center here. So for those of you, when you're looking at weight and balance, you're like, man, those wings are way far back. Well, the center weight had to be this far back based on the payload. And so that forced the wing to be so far back, which then forces a huge tail to try and keep everything stable, if you guys are, for those of you who are familiar with that. The second iteration of that then was this next version. You can see the aircraft slightly different. That's the cadet team. This was in spring of 2017, so we just finished this year. You can see the aircraft sitting on the runway there, and then this is it flying up in our airspace. So it flew fairly well. The cadets are really happy because after we got done with this semester, about a week later, AFRL released their version of the same thing. Now, they funded our project, but what was really cool is we're not sure if they stole portions of our design or... So this was their, right here, you can see that is their mock-up of it. And it's actually not flying, it's just something that, it's a simulation that they built this rendering and then put there. But ours actually flies, so the cadets were pretty excited about that. All right, faster, funnier? Okay, so, I say that in class all the time. Faster, funnier. So here is the next thing I wanted to talk about. It's the DARPA Service Academy Swarming Challenge. I know a lot of us have heard about swarming and where are we at in the state of art and who's been doing swarming. Well, we were the first to, Georgia Tech Research Institute with DARPA was the first to do, I think they did 50 aircraft. We were the first to actually do a mix of UAV aircraft at one time. DARPA, there's a DARPA program out there, it's got 2 years left on it, and we were invited to join in on it. And so we did 25v25 swarming aerial combat with the other two service academies. So both the Army and the Navy were involved in this. You can see right here, I guess I'll go over here, the combat cube was a 500 meters by 500 meters by 500 meters, although the picture doesn't show it, and then it was 50 meters off of the ground. And so it was essentially this cube in the sky that we had combat, and then that the two different swarms would fight each other. And then you would launch from one site or the other site, and then if you were on your side, it was a defensive side, and then on the other side was offensive. We went out to each team from the Army, Navy, and Air Force academies, built their teams, and then we went to Camp Roberts for the competition, which was in April. And all right, here's how, any Army or Navy folks in the audience? So, okay, Army or Navy?
Navy.
Navy, okay, well, you beat us. So we crushed Army, both Navy and the Air Force crushed Army in the competition, but we actually lost to Navy. Now, interestingly enough, the way it was set up is that all of the aircraft were provided. The technological, as far as the electronics and the networks to talk to all the different aircraft were provided. And it was conducted with 100% knowledge, meaning I knew exactly where everybody was at, and they knew where I was at, where my aircraft were. We didn't play the sensor game, saying, oh, well, I need to sense somebody before I can track them and then try to negate. It was purely knowing where everybody was at. So it was focused on the behaviors that each of the teams came up with. And so the behaviors then became the focus of it. Our cadets came up with three offensive behaviors and two defensive behaviors. The number one behavior that they really liked was called greedy shooter. And so all it really did is every aircraft just went out and said, okay, nearest bad guy, that's what I'm going for. Nearest bad, and they just all went out. So you can imagine the chaos that happens when you do that. And so that's the one they preferred. It wasn't as effective as we were hoping for. And then they had some others that were, I'm a greedy shooter, but I'm a smart greedy shooter. If you're closer, I'm going to let you go negate that threat, and I'm going to go take a different threat. So that was the competition. We went out there. Like I said, we both beat the military academy. Now, we went to the competition, and the Air Force Academy was the only academy that could launch its own aircraft. So I thought from that perspective, who really won this competition? But that's all right. So we trained all our cadets to have teams of, you know, that launched. And so we had 10 quadcopters and 15 fixed wings that were up, you know, competing with each other. And then what happened on the day of the competition against Navy is we about an hour before the competition began, they pushed a new software load to us. So those of you that are in the software, right, you know, and they pushed a new software load to us, to all the aircraft. And then since we were so ready, so good at launching, we launched all of our aircraft. Well, that software load, whoever decided to build it the night before, forgot to split out all the altitudes of the aircraft. So all of our aircraft went to the same altitude at the same point, and so we didn't realize it until we already had four of them launched. And so four of them were up there, and of course we had two midairs between those. So all four of those aircraft crashed and came down into a heaping mess. And so then we said, well, you know, let us redo the competition. Navy hadn't, DARPA hadn't launched Navy's aircraft yet. And so and we said, well, let us restart the competition. No, no, we're going to keep going the way it is. So we lost the Navy, and I'm not saying that's the reason why, but I'm saying that's the reason why. Okay, good. So, but it was a good time. The cadets had a great opportunity. Now, if you are in a university that has an aeronautics program, DARPA is considering opening up the Swarm Challenge to all universities next year. So keep your eyes open. It'll be something interesting to look at, very high-profile kind of exercise. I think what you have to do is demonstrate your ability to meet the objectives, that kind of thing. But they're opening it up. This is kind of what it looks like. So everything was virtual, right? There was no, we weren't really shooting anything at anybody. It was just, if you got into a certain position, then it would consider that threat negated. There's the launcher that we used, and those are the small aircraft that that were launched. Okay, now one of the interesting things that our cadets did was they decided, went above and beyond, because we had a larger group in, we're the Air Force Academy, so we had to go for it, and built a virtual world. So much as you're talking about using the HTC, I think they have HTC virtual sets. And so what they did is they built the entire battlefield in a virtual reality headset kind of thing, and they brought that to the competition. And so you could see, and we ported in all the positions of all the UAVs. So rather than sitting on a computer trying to click and trying to get, you know, a one-dimensional image, Our cadets actually had a virtual reality space set up where you could put on the headset and you could see all of our UAVs flying and all of their UAVs flying, and you could move around the battle space in virtual and spin around and look at the, you know, look at what they're doing against us, and then assign behaviors to whatever aircraft you wanted to make do certain things. With the use of these little pointers. And so here, I know this is a lousy picture, but this is one of them. The only graphic they could find was B-2s. So all the planes looked like B-2s, which is okay because they were kind of diamond shaped. But they would use that little pointer you saw, point at an aircraft, and then assign it a different behavior. Say, for example, they wanted it to go defensive. So I'm thinking, John, we need to team up, and next year our cadets will show up on site with headsets and walk around thinking of the planes to make them do what they need to do. But we're probably pretty close to, I know, yeah. So the other thing we did too is we brought along one of the, Microsoft, I'm sorry that I forgot the name, but it's the virtual headset where you look at a desktop and it looks like a holographic image. I don't know if you guys have seen that. The HoloLens, thank you. Yeah, we took the HoloLens with us and did the same thing. Set up the combat fight with the HoloLens so the generals could walk around. And we got quite a large audience there at the HoloLens, so they could see the fight in virtual, so it was really cool. Okay, and that was the competition. The last thing I'll mention is our UAS, counter-UAS support. So like I was mentioning, the proliferation of autopilots and subscale electronics is really huge. It is growing significantly right now, and it's a significant threat. And so what we've been doing is we've been building teams of red and blue air. Well, we'll go out and we will be bad guys so that the good guys, Army, Navy, Air Force, can defend against us. And it's been kind of an interesting exercise. It's interesting, you learn a lot about bad guys when you pretend to be one against the good guys. And so we've learned a lot about this kind of issue and fighting these types of threats. And so there's my cadets working. Here's our team. Some lessons learned. It's not an ivory tower fight. My cadets were adaptable. Their wings would break off. They, you know, glue them back on. They, you know, whatever. Put tape on it, slap it up, and launch the next plane. You know, and they did a really good job versus some of the more professional engineering teams that showed up that were kind of like, everything has to be just perfect. They had limited success as compared to my guys, kind of more of the Mad Max mentality. So we had a good time. And there they are building a bunch of targets that are going to be shot down the next day. And that's it. Next semester, then, we're going to tackle VTOL fixed wing.
Should be an opportunity to mix some of the capabilities of a multi-copter with a fixed wing aircraft. So that's what hopefully we'll be doing successfully next year. All right.
And we've got about 5 minutes for questions.
Questions? Can I answer any questions? Yes, ma'am.
So my son is busy designing drones. They're not flying drones. They're walking around. So I'm not clear on what exactly is one person assigned to each of these guys to fly it? How remote
right.
are they?
Right.
How autonomous are they?
Yeah. So from the perspective of the research that we're doing and what we did this last semester, I was uncomfortable. The Air Force gave us the freedom in controlled airspace where even if they were to fly off, it would be okay because we're in controlled airspace, to control up to 25 aircraft with one ground control station. I was uncomfortable with that number, and so we actually split it up to 5 per one. So I would have a single operator who could take command of any of the aircraft. And if we flew up to 25, we'd have at least 5 separate operators that could take command of whatever, if there was some sort of problem with the UAVs. So, yeah.
So they are remote rather than autonomous?
Well, they are autonomous, but if there's some sort of problem, then they can take command of it. But so, essentially, all of the behaviors were set them up. After we launched it, they went to a hold point, and then as soon as the competition began, we would hit begin, and they would start doing their things all autonomously.
So your teams were responsible to write programs for these behaviors?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And responsible for the safety and trying to, get them launched.
So they're hitting each other.
Yeah, right. That too, yep. Sir?
What is your research for the sort of Delta Wing no control surfaces aircraft?
Oh, ICE, Innovative Control Effector, yes.
What does that mean for, say, Delta Wing commercial aircraft?
would I do that? I don't know. In fact, I work with another test pilot down there. We're both a retired test pilot. He's a fighter type as well. So the two of us sit and kind of speculate, would I be comfortable with something that was Delta Wing that was manned that didn't actually have flight controls? I don't think so. I think at this point, what we would do is probably have flight control surfaces that are available if required, but aren't deployed on a regular basis. If you wanted the aircraft to be stealthy, you could go into stealth mode where the thing's flying with just these blown actuators moving vortices around. But then if you really needed an emergency situation, you'd still have the control surfaces as a backup. That's where we're at right now, personally, after kind of working the project for a bit.
What would be fuel consumption compared to a standard?
Oh, as far as savings with trim drag and such. Yeah, we considered that as well. You understand, depending on how off condition you are with the aircraft as far as you're not flying at the speed at which it was designed, when we're flying an airline transport, we design it for cruise at, and so if you're on condition, you do fairly well on trim and trim, your control surfaces aren't deployed much. But in that kind of sense, if you are on condition and that controller is just providing a little bit of air, I think you would have some fuel savings. Off condition, we think it's going to be worse because the requirement to provide that high pressure air also requires the motor pulls bleed air off the motor. So the motor we're going to test here next year will be a motor where we ported bleed air off of the main jet engine, and then ported bleed air is what's going to provide the ejectors, if you will.
We want to thank our speaker. All right. Thank you.